I took the name of the guy who'd threatened Grant's life. Went to Brady's office. Brady called Antonelli.
Your client needs police protection, Brady said.
Antonelli put Grant on the phone, and Brady put him on speaker. Grant said,
I don't want to see another cop for as long as I live. Get me? Someone threatened you, Mr. Grant. I'm not worried, said Grant.
Brady threw up his hands. We'd tried. He left for the day at 5, which may have been the first time since I've known him. I left a minute or two after that. I had to fight off 3 reporters' requests for just one question, Sergeant, on my way to the car. At home, I cooked your basic spaghetti with marinara sauce and meatballs for me and Julie. We walked our good dog, after which I bathed Julie, read her a book with kittens and ponies in it, and put her to bed. At 8, I was starting to relax. I had shut off the TV and was ready for an early night in bed when Brady called. There was no acceptable reason to ignore his call. I said my name into the phone. He said,
Boxer, here's a no-surprise surprise.
I listened as Brady told me that Connor Grant had called him directly.
He says gunshots were fired through his window, that someone is trying to kill him. He wants protection. You heard me. I told him I had wanted to assign cars to his house.
I remember vividly, I said. Brady scoffed.
Well, he's changed his mind, done a U-turn. Conklin is on the way over to Bayview. You go too. Maybe now that he's scared, he might blurt out something semi-useful.
I was wearing fluffy socks and my favorite pajamas. I'd been 10 minutes from Dreamland. Okay, I said. Okay. I hung up with Brady, called the darling Mrs. Gloria Rose. I asked her, will you do a shift with Julie, please? She's already eaten. She's asleep.
When have I ever said no?
I thanked the number one best nanny in the world, threw on clean jeans and a cotton pullover, jammed shoes onto my aching feet. After Mrs. Rose crossed the hall to my place, I looked in on Julie and told her I'd be home before she knew it. She rolled over and turned her face to the wall. I told Mrs. Rose I'd call her. Then I booked. Chapter 54. I trotted over to 12th Street, where I had parked my new second-hand Explorer, a newer model than my former beloved ride, which had been shot to pieces while I was behind the wheel. The new car had bells and whistles I didn't need, but the same comfortable seat height, 5-star crash rating, and curve control. Add that to its zippy pickup and quiet ride, and this was the perfect vehicle for me. Before pulling out, I called Conklin. I'm about 25 minutes out, I told him. I heard sirens through my phone.
I'm a block away, he said. Suggest you step on it.
I gunned the engine and headed to Jamestown Avenue in Bayview, where Connor Grant lived. As it had been the first time I came to his place, the tidy wood frame house set back from the street and flanked by 2 concrete buildings was hemmed in by a formation of squad cars. But now, in the dark, its plain, everyday exterior was animated by cherry lights whirling, flashing, and strobing the landscape. Conklin was standing on the front steps of the house talking to Grant. I badged the uniforms between me and the front door and joined my partner and the psycho who was officially innocent of all charges. If the shooter who had shot out his windows was watching, he could be on a rooftop or inside a parked car. To tell the truth, I didn't much care if Grant got picked off while standing on his porch. But I did care about my partner's safety and mine. I said, we should go inside. We followed Grant into his multi-purpose living room. I felt creeped out just being in close proximity to him. But still, there was an opportunity here. Everything about Grant seemed to be some kind of act. From the first time I met him, all starry-eyed in the face of death and destruction, to the time he cross-examined me like a professional legal sharpshooter, Connor Grant didn't compute. I might never get into this house again, but maybe there was something in plain sight that would give me a peephole into the enigma that was Connor Grant. I crossed the living room and walked through the open doorway to his office. There was an even bigger pile of mail than before stacked on the credenza, and next to his armchair were four plastic tubs of mail the post office had been holding for him. Grant interrupted my thoughts. He said,
"Well, Sergeant, took you long enough to get here."
I stifled a snappy comeback that he had rejected police protection and that I wasn't his personal muscle. Instead, I said, "Why don't you tell us what happened?" Grant pointed up to the second floor.
"I was upstairs watching a movie when the window shattered."
He pulled the collar of his shirt away to show us glass cuts on his cheek and neck. I nodded, but I had no sympathy for Grant. The little nicks in his skin only reminded me again of the shower of glass shards flying hundreds of feet in all directions. Lit by sundown for bonus points. Grant said,
"I rolled off the bed onto the floor. When the shots stopped coming, I peeked out the window. I saw a car lurch and head north. I got three letters off the license plate."
I wrote down the letters. "What kind of car?"
"I couldn't tell. It was dark colored and had a boxy rear end."
"Like a van?" He nodded.
"Could have been."
"How many shots were fired?" I asked.
"Four, maybe five."
"Have you gotten any threatening phone calls?"
"Only three or four an hour on my landline. You're lower than pond scum. You should die." I unplugged the phone.
I told Grant we'd try to get records of incoming calls from the phone company, and I jotted down his cell phone number for the record. While Grant took Conklin around the small house to do a security check on the doors and windows, I switched on the lamp near Grant's easy chair and turned it so it lit up his library, which wrapped around two sides of the small room. I had only a couple of minutes, but I gave his bookshelves another look. Scanning the spines, I saw books on law, art history, archaeology, astronomy, and notable people from A to Z. Grant also had a section on guns, about 3 feet of shelving dedicated to explosives, a section on aeronautics, as well as a top shelf with books on psychology and computer science. Besides my personal experience with Grant acting as his own attorney, Yuki had told me how he'd distinguished himself throughout the trial. Question: how had he managed to educate himself with law books and retain enough practical knowledge to put on such a skillful defense against Len Parisi? I pulled out an intriguingly titled book, Satan's Advice to Young Lawyers. I opened it and saw a book plate. "This book belongs to," and the inscription, "Sam Marks." A random sampling of three more law books had the same book plate and inscribed name, Sam Marks. Maybe Grant had bought the collection at a tag sale or from a secondhand bookstore. But why? I heard footsteps on the stairs. Grant was telling Conklin,
"I was falsely arrested and tried. My reputation has been trashed. Now I could be assassinated. I was stupid to turn down police protection, but now I demand it."
I left the living room and met Grant and Conklin in the foyer. "We'll get you round-the-clock surveillance for a while," I told him. "But if I were you, I'd move."
"You really have a hate on for me, don't you, Sergeant?"
Grant said.
"Do I remind you of someone? Do you have a problem with intelligent men? Do you just like to throw your weight around? You should get over your superiority complex. You're not that superior."
I handed him my card, saying, "We'll check on that partial plate as well as incoming phone calls. Any more shooting incidents, call 911, then call me."
"You mean, if I'm not dead?"
Conklin said,
"Consider taking Sergeant Boxer's advice about moving. She's usually right."
Chapter 55. 5 minutes later, Conklin and I were sitting in his car in front of the mass murderer's sweet little blue and white house. "I can't possibly say how much I hate that guy," I said.
"You've got good reason," he said.
"Linz, just do what you're doing. Stay cool. We do our jobs, and maybe some superhero will take him the fuck out."
"If only," he laughed. "My partner, the good cop." Conklin fed the three letters Grant had given us into the mobile data terminal while I watched the street. Five squad cars pulled out into the night, leaving two cruisers behind to protect the not-guilty mother of all dirtbags. Conklin whistled through his teeth as the software ran all the plate combinations with the letters WXL in San Francisco.
"Got a Land Rover with a WYL," he said.
"Registered to?"
"Carrie Woodhouse, of all people. Could be his plate, or just pretty damn close to it."
We knew that Woodhouse had lost his wife in the Cytron explosion and had threatened Connor Grant inside a packed courtroom. "If Woodhouse did the drive-by, he wasted no time," I said. "What can we find out about him?" Conklin tapped the keys and said,
"He's a career soldier. Christ, the guy's an actual hero. Desert Storm."
While I stared up at Grant's shot-out bedroom window, Conklin phoned Brady and told him,
"Grant got three letters off the probable shooter's plate. Two of them match Woodhouse's vehicle. I'm thinking this was harassment or a warning. If the shooter had seriously wanted to kill Grant, he could have come through the front door. Cheap locks, no cameras."
Brady's voice came over the speaker, telling Conklin he'd put out an APB on the vehicle in question, and that he wanted us to drive to the Woodhouse residence.
"Report back," said Brady.
A CSI van rolled up to Grant's house and parked. I got out of Conklin's car, walked over to the van, and spoke to George Campbell, a former science teacher himself, and now a CSI on the graveyard shift. We talked about the shots fired, and I asked him to call me when he'd gotten back the ballistics on the slugs. "Put a hot rush on it," I said. "And Campbell, while you're hunting for slugs, if anything strikes you as weird or out of place, call me."
"I sure will."
I walked back to Conklin's car, thinking that even if Campbell found a notebook with actual hand-lettered instructions on how to blow up Cytron, Grant would still be not guilty. Double jeopardy applied. Still, I needed to know if he had done it. Conklin buzzed down his window and said,
"Ready?"
"I'll follow you." I got into my car, switched on the engine, gave it some gas, and was two car lengths behind Conklin as we headed out. Chapter 56. Carrie Woodhouse lived in Parkside on 24th Avenue. The house was of the tiled roof Mediterranean style that had been popular in the 1930s, and along with the similar homes on this street, it looked fresh and well tended. Conklin pulled into Woodhouse's driveway behind a boxy, dark-colored Land Rover. I double-parked on the street, and Conklin and I put on our Kevlar vests and our SFPD windbreakers over them. We approached the front door together. I rang the bell, and in a minute the door opened. The guy in the doorway was barrel-chested, wearing a blue plaid flannel shirt and baggy cords, standing 6 feet tall in his bedroom slippers. He had a butt in his hand. I introduced myself and Conklin, asked if he was Mr. Carrie Woodhouse.
"Yes. What's this about?"
Conklin said,
"We'd like to ask you a couple of questions, sir. Better if we come inside."
Woodhouse flung the door wide open and said,
"Come right in. I'm on a streak, so I hope this won't take too long. Some of the boys have to get home to their wives."
I checked out the house as we walked in. Stucco walls, overstuffed furniture, framed photo of Mrs. Woodhouse draped in black hanging over the fireplace. An arched pass-through connected the living room to the dining room, where five men in their 40s to mid-60s sat around the snack and beer bottle-laden dining room table. They were holding cards. Conklin said to Woodhouse,
"We can talk in the kitchen." "No, just come in and ask what you want. I don't have secrets from my friends and family."
Woodhouse took his seat at the head, named the men at the table, including his father, Micah, and his brother, Jeff. After turning down an offer to pull up a chair, Conklin asked Woodhouse,
"Have you driven your car this evening?" "Of course. Went out for food and beer. What's this about?"
Conklin said,
"About this shopping trip. Were you in Bayview?" "Bayview? No. I went to the Lucky on Sloat." "You didn't answer me, son, and I'm asking you for the third and final time before I kick you the hell out. What's this about?" Shots were fired through Connor Grant's windows this evening at around 8. A car was spotted leaving the area that matches the description of your Land Rover.
Oh, I see. This is because I shouted at that scum sucker. Was he killed, I hope?
One of the men at the table said.
8 o'clock. Carrie was right here at 8, wasn't he, boys?
The men around the table agreed.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right here.
And?
I can vouch for that.
Woodhouse smiled, put down his beer bottle.
I've got, count 'em, 5 alibis. Any other questions?
I said, what kind of guns do you own, Mr. Woodhouse? Woodhouse said,
oh, come on. I have a lot of weapons, and some of them are recently fired. I used them at the gun club range this morning. If you want to check them out, I guess you're going to need a warrant.
I said, Mr. Woodhouse, if anything should happen to Connor Grant, you're suspect number 1.
Duly noted,
he said, giving me a look that could stop a tank in its tracks. He went on to say,
I can't believe that you, of all people, are trying to protect that maniac. Please, show yourselves out.
Woodhouse placed a deck of cards in front of the older man to his right.
Dad, you're up. Dealer's choice.
Out again on the street, Rich and I said our goodnights. With luck, I'd be back in my favorite PJs in a half hour. As for Dreamland, I wasn't sure I still had a ticket. Chapter 57. Nettie Lambeau was pacing in Ward 6 of the North Tower just after lights out. He walked from window to the bathroom and back to the bunk room, restless as a man could be. He thought about Mr. Holmes, the broker he'd put down, and the story on the 6 o'clock news hour about Salesman of the Month Bobby Ricardo's heart attack. That he was so young and so well-regarded and how much he'd be missed. And it just pissed Nettie off. Big time. Yes, indeed, it was a good thing that Bobby Ricardo had gotten all the attention. But it was maddening not to get any himself. People had thought he was a true moron since he was a little kid, and he'd learned how to work that angle to perfection. But sometimes, like right now, he wished a woman or even a shrink would see that someone was home inside of Nettie Lambeau, that he was someone very special and very smart. Nettie paced some more. He looked at his sleeping bunkies, Fred Mouse and Quarter to 10. He blew on Oscar's face until the old dude flipped onto his stomach. He hid Goose Thompson's shoe in Randy Rockefeller's trunk because Goose would go full-bore insane when he couldn't find his shoe. But Nettie was getting nowhere fast. Or slow, either. He had a lot of anger right now thinking about that damned real estate salesman, and he had to blow it off. He had been at the loony bin for 36 years and had amassed many privileges. The best of them was not the bunk by the window, the seat at the head of the table, or the title of dorm dad. It was that he could leave the bin on his own. Normally, he spaced out these trips abroad. He'd put down the broker only a week ago, but tonight, since the TV coverage of the big funeral for Bobby Ricardo, he felt an urgent need to fly. But where to go? Nettie knew the vast network of underground spaces beneath San Francisco as if he'd designed those secret places himself. For one thing, there were the former speakeasies that had been the major entertainment during Prohibition. Along with the speakeasies, there had been brothels galore, many of them underground and connected by secret passageways. Many or even most of the older buildings from that time had storage rooms that went out under the sidewalks and sometimes under the streets, too. Even ships were buried downtown, and Nettie had seen them, walked through and over them. It was just fantastic. He'd even been to a place under a saloon where sailors had been shanghaied, sold to merchant ships. And then there was the entire Embarcadero with its wide sidewalk built over a beach and a bay. It was all true. Nettie knew where these secret rooms connected and where the tunnels surfaced. He had his own private runways and escape hatches under the buildings and pavement. He had done the cartography in his mind. He'd done it himself. He was not as dumb and crazy and brain-damaged as he appeared to be in the files and folders about him, in the books that the shrinks wrote about their patients, labeled with numbers instead of names, in his reflection in the glassy eyes of the nurses who hardly thought of him at all. He tickled the feet of the man sleeping in the bunk next to his.
Mike, Mike, Mike.
What, Nettie? What do you want now?
I can't keep you safe from meanies tonight, Mikey. I have to fly.
Go, Nettie. I'm strong. Loud Mike can take care of himself.
Yes.
Nettie Lambeau, space-time traveler, king of the underground. Where should he go tonight? Chapter 58. It was after 9 p.m. when Nettie took the stairs down from Ward 6 to the basement-level tunnel, which was the corridor to many service rooms, including the kitchen and the laundry. It also ran between the loony bin and St. Vartan's Medical Center. Nettie wore a black hoodie under a hip-length denim jacket. His weapon of choice was in his pocket, and his most serious running shoes peeked out from the legs of his jeans. Dodging the few orderlies and maintenance workers using the underground tunnel at that hour, Nettie stuck to the shadows, then exited through the medical waste room under St. Vartan's and walked a block and a half overland to Jones Street. Jones had once been a hive of speakeasies with escape hatches into underground hidey rooms, and Nettie knew the whole subterranean network better than anyone. There, in front of the wainscot, was one of Nettie's best portals. He sat on the curb and had to wait only a minute for a burst of traffic to pass before removing the storm drain cover at his feet and climbing inside. He smoothly replaced the cover and began his descent down the metal ladder, his eyes quickly adjusting to the dark. Once he reached the bottom of the ladder, it was an easy sprint along the old speakeasy connector to the manhole at 6th and Stevenson. Nettie was not only swift, he was nimble. He made the short hand-over-hand climb, listened for a break in traffic, then shouldered open the heavy lid capping the entrance to the tunnel. Above ground again, Nettie walked in darkness, making turns along well-traveled streets into narrow alleys, passing strollers and dog walkers in ones and twos in Sue Bierman Park. He kept his hood up, his hands in his pockets, his eyes down, finally taking a pathway at the end of Drum to the Embarcadero. Nettie found the Embarcadero, that super-wide avenue running along the bay, exhilarating. There was so much traffic here, both car and pedestrian, that no one noticed him. Several months ago, he had made a perfect kill beside the waterside restaurant. The beige woman. But before he'd been able to see and really feel the thrill of her death, something unimaginable had overshadowed his own sweet success. He'd been cheated. Tonight, he would take back what had been so rudely stolen from him. Tonight belonged to Nettie Lambeau. Chapter 59. Nettie crossed the Embarcadero at Broadway and proceeded to a small patio with potted trees and benches next to the waterside restaurant, where customers had a smoke or waited for their rides. As he stepped onto the patio, his fading memories of the beige woman flooded over him in HD and living color. He could see her now, wearing a beige-colored knit skirt and jacket. She had been deeply engrossed in her phone and was reading out directions to herself. She hadn't noticed the slight man with sandy hair and deformed arms, so he had said,
"Hey, I'm Nettie."
She had turned away, both showing her disgust and giving him a full view of the target. He hadn't hesitated. He had pulled his fully loaded sharp from his pocket and had stuck her hard in her meaty haunch, pushing the plunger at the same time. She had grabbed at her rear end and swiveled to stare at him. Nettie had had her attention then. He had stared back into her gray-blue eyes for one long moment. Then she had wheezed before stepping off the curb into oncoming traffic. A taxicab had just brushed her, but she had been off balance and had fallen. She had still been alive. She had been flapping and flailing in the gutter when there had been a boom like a jet breaking the sound barrier directly overhead. Nettie had seen the sky change from sunset to a blackout smothering gray. He had known that he had to run, and he had done so, camouflaged by the chaos, disappearing below the surface for long tunnel runs, reappearing on empty streets as if from nowhere. But the loss of his big moment stayed with him. He hadn't seen the beige woman die. Tonight he would try to claw that moment back. There was no rush. No need to panic. Before him ranged the whole panorama of promenade and restaurant and patio and sky. He relived the way the beige woman had looked at him and actually seen him just before she was hit by the taxi. Nettie was filling in the missing details, going in for a close-up of her last breath, when he was interrupted again. A police car, cruising in a northbound lane, pulled up only yards away from where he was standing. Two cops, a man and a woman, got out of the cruiser and headed toward him. Nettie froze as they approached, blinding him with their flashlights. Why had they stopped for him? "Any problem here?" asked the tall woman cop.
"No problem," said Nettie in his pitchy, nutty Nettie voice. "No problem at all, officer. I was just looking at the water, just looking at the water."
The flashlight beam flicked up and down his body. What were they looking for? What did they see? Had someone witnessed his killing right here? Had that witness reported him to the police? Were cops watching this place to see if the killer returned? Nettie shielded his eyes with a crooked forearm.
"Just looking at the water," he said again.
The male cop said,
"All right, then. Have a good night."
"Thanks, officers. I'm going now. Going now. Bye."
By the time he'd crossed back over the Embarcadero, his rosy and beautiful mood had changed to a menacing gray cloud, just as the sky had changed after he'd made his kill. He'd been cheated again. "This isn't fair," he said to himself. "Not fair at all." Chapter 60. Nettie was walking west on Broadway, agitated, muttering, mad at himself for returning to the crime scene. It had been a rookie mistake, and he'd gotten exactly nothing for it. Now he had to take a different route home, throw off anyone who might be looking for him. Using the Transamerica Pyramid directly to the left as his guiding star, he walked at a normal pace, skirting the tourist magnet of North Beach. Passing the Green Tortoise Hostel, he approached the intersection of Broadway and Columbus Avenue, all of the neon blazing North Beach spread out to his right. Cars sped past him. Crowds of so-called normal people laughed and joked and touched and teased. It was a world he wasn't part of, but here was a gift. He could move through it unseen. Nutty Nettie, a.k.a. Special Ed, continued on Broadway and hooked a left onto Powell, following it up to the top of Knob Hill, until one of his favorite flight paths was in view. The cable car tracks turned from Jackson onto Powell, and Nettie waited for the car to rattle to a stop. He grabbed the bar and swung himself up, handed his Muni pass to the conductor. The conductor looked at Nettie's pass, not his face. He was working, and this was one of 600 tickets and passes he would check that night. Nettie was on board, ready for takeoff. He worked his way to the front of the car and mentally urged the car to the crest of the hill. And then the car dropped over the top. He loved this gliding feeling as the car plunged downward. Union Square was on the left, the Macy's sign was across the way, and the monument to Admiral Dewey stood centered in the square. Moments later, too soon, the car squealed to a halt, and Nettie jumped off and headed east. His feelings of shame and loss at the cop stop near the patio were abating. He had made his greatest strides from his biggest mistakes. Notably, there was the crime that had turned his life into this.
Blazing light poured through the entrance of the Admiral Dewey Hotel. A taxi pulled up, and a doorman opened the taxi door for a couple dressed for a gala. The doorman walked them to the glass doors and opened them. As Nettie passed the hotel, he was struck by the sight of a woman standing alone, 40 feet away from the front of the hotel. She looked to be in her late 30s, with light brown hair in a long braid. She had a bland face that reminded him of the beige woman. He would give her a test. He walked toward her and heard himself say, "Hi, I'm Nettie." Her gaze passed over him as she turned away without speaking. Her disrespect, her disgust, sent a shiver through Nettie, and he saw that this was how he would rectify his earlier mistake. He turned toward the wall and loaded his sharp. The woman with the braid was staring off into the distance when Nettie jabbed her in the buttock, delivered the payload, pulled out the syringe, and sidestepped out into the street. He heard a short bark and turned to see the dead woman walking, her arms reaching out as she silently mouthed, "Help."
"Sorry, no," Nettie said, passing her. "Goodbye," he said. "Almost nice knowing you."
A crowd of people piled out of the hotel, and immediately someone noticed the woman lying in the street. He heard a panicky male voice saying, "Hang on, I'm getting help." Then, "Oh my God, she's gone." As the crowd dispersed, Nettie glimpsed the dead woman and sighed with pleasure. Job well done. And now he had to go. He walked at a normal pace up Stockton Street, crossed Union Square, nondescript in his hoodie and jeans in the dark. He ditched out onto Post Street, only dimly lit at this hour, and then St. Vartan's loomed. He walked fast, but not rushed, and 10 minutes later the brick walls of the hide-and-seek loony bin were in view. The admin block was dark. There was an even darker void between the walls of the North Tower and the Walgreens, and Nettie slipped inside that shaft of blackness. He was as good as invisible. But inside his body, Nettie was glowing like a neon-lit night. Mission accomplished. Nettie was safe. And Nettie was good. Very, very good. Chapter 61. I was with Claire in the autopsy suite, staring down at a human heart in a stainless steel surgical bowl. The victim, Sarah Summers Nugent, was lying nearby on a table, chest opened from her clavicle down, her face in repose. Claire was saying, "This heart could run a marathon by itself." "I'll take your word for it. What do you know about the circumstances?" "Last night around 10, she was waiting outside the Admiral Dewey Hotel for her husband to check out. They had a plane to catch, going to Chicago. Husband came outside with their bags, saw a crowd in the street and his wife on the ground in the middle of it. First responders arrived within 5 minutes and found her non-responsive. Mr. Nugent went with Sarah in the bus. Emergency room at Metro made it official. Mrs. Nugent was DOA, looked like cardiac arrest. The husband told the attending physician that his wife was only 41, that she had just aced a full checkup. As far as he or she knew, she did not have any indications of heart disease." I was listening to Claire, looking at the victim's heart, but my mind was roaming over the other so-called heart attack victims whose deaths we had investigated. There were the first two victims that had aroused Claire's suspicions. Lois Sprague, the female tourist who had been brought in with the Cytron fatalities. Claire had connected Sprague's death to that of a male cab driver who actually did have heart disease, as well as a needle mark in his left buttock. Conklin and I had checked into the third known victim, the homeless addict discovered by the landscaper. The landscaper had no information about the attacker, and the victim had no known relatives, which left us with no motive for his murder. Last week, a real estate broker named Robert Ricardo, 36, had left his office for a breath of air when, without warning, he'd dropped dead on the sidewalk. His death would have been chalked up to cardiac arrest if Claire hadn't gotten the word out to the pathologists in all the hospitals in the city. I was thinking of him as victim number 4. Homicide Central Station would be working the Ricardo case, but the lead investigator, Marty Freeman, had called to tell me that he had no idea what happened to the victim. The tox report was normal. The man's heart was normal. The victim had no enemies, no nothing.
Boxer, this man should not be dead, he told me.
Claire had ruled the manner of death undetermined, knowing full well that she was looking at a murder victim and couldn't prove it. I was mired in what the hell. Same as Claire, same as Marty Freeman. There was a pattern that didn't form a picture. What could possibly be the motive for the deaths of these people who had nothing in common? Cops like to say, if you know the why, you can figure out the who. The why was a mystery. But the killer, whoever, however, and for whatever reason, was stepping up his schedule. The first four victims had been killed within several months. Now, with the death of Sarah Nugent, two victims had been murdered in the last week. I shared these thoughts with Claire and asked her, what's your report going to say?
Manner of death, homicide. Cause, unknown substance injected into the right buttock.
Mrs. Nugent's blood just went to the lab, she said. Let's hope for a clue. She wrote the husband's contact information on her notepad, ripped off the top sheet and handed it to me. Carl Nugent, room 982, Admiral Dewey Hotel.
For whatever it's worth, she said.
Actually, Mrs. Nugent's death was our first fresh lead into the needle stickers case, and that was priceless. I'll call you later, I said. I showed myself out. Chapter 62. It was just before 10 in the morning when Conklin and I entered the open arms of the Admiral Dewey and found Carl Nugent in the nearly empty bar. He was white, mid-50s, average height and weight, and looked as though he'd been wadded up and thrown against the back of the circular booth. I introduced my partner and myself to Mr. Nugent and asked if we could join him. Then we slid onto the leather seat, flanking him on both sides. Conklin told Nugent that we were sorry for his loss. Nugent's words slurred together when he said,
Yeah, well, nowhere as sorry as I am. Useless without Sari. Total mess without my Sari.
Then he folded his arms on the table, knocking over a largish glass of liquor without noticing, put his head down, and sobbed. Conklin reached an arm across the man's back and patted him. A waiter appeared with a dishcloth. He sopped up the alcohol and left a stack of paper napkins. Nugent blotted his face and made an attempt to collect himself, but it was clear that he was grieving his heart out. Finally, I said, Mr. Nugent, can you tell us what happened last night?
I wish to God I knew.
The waiter returned with a refill for Nugent, asked if we would like anything. After we said no, we asked the widower to talk about the reasons for his trip to San Francisco. Nugent told us that he and his wife were inventors and had come here to meet with department store buyers. He pulled a golf ball-sized globe with electric prongs out of his pocket, saying it was a nightlight they called Smartlight. He explained briefly that Smartlight detected motion, was interactive, and had a wireless hookup to neighbors, the fire department, and the police.
Sari's brainchild,
he said sadly.
It could save lives.
I asked, can you think of anyone who would have wanted to hurt your wife?
Over our gadget? Whoa. What are you? Sari had a heart attack, didn't she?
The medical examiner is doing a full workup. She hasn't determined the cause of death. That was pretty much true. I asked Nugent questions about his travel plans, the state of his marriage, and if either he or his wife had been harassed in person, on the phone, or on the internet. The bereaved man had no answers, and after he put down his empty glass, he had zero ability to focus. The manager had a bellman take him to his room, and Rich and I talked about the work we had in front of us, checking Nugent's financials, his insurance policies, his internet life. But I didn't see anything in this man that would lead me to think he had killed his wife. We interviewed the day manager and the door and lobby staff, including the doorman who had been on the scene when Mrs. Nugent went down. He was earnest and professional, and he had called 911. But his back had been to the street when the shouting started. We headed back to the hall with plans to return in 3 hours and interview the night staff. I said to my partner, "We've got male victims, female victims, local folks and out-of-towners, some that were well-off and some that were street sleepers. Were they all victims of opportunity? Does the perp just kill at random?" Rich turned down the radio.
I realized I'd been shouting.
I said it again. "Let's run Nugent's name through the computer."
"Copy that, Captain Obvious."
Conklin was laughing when Brady called.
"Boxer, you got Conklin with you?"
"He's right here."
"Good. Our favorite science teacher was beaten up pretty good last night. He's conscious and talking. Why don't you head on over to San Francisco General?"
Chapter 63. Connor Grant was lying in a hospital bed, snoring loudly. His eyes were blackened, his nose was taped, and every part of him that I could see was bruised, contused, or abraded. Looked like after he'd been beaten all to hell, he'd been dragged behind a pickup for a couple of miles. Conklin said,
"Shit."
I grunted my agreement. Despite my revulsion for Connor Grant, I felt bad for the guy. But my mind had its own agenda. I flashed on the moment when I saw Joe being evacuated from Cytron on a stretcher. He'd been almost unrecognizable. I remembered his comatose days when he'd been straddling a wobbly line between life and death. Even now, he was in pain because of this man. I said, "Mr. Grant?" I touched his arm and he jolted awake, pulling back as though I was going to hit him. "Mr. Grant, it's Sergeant Boxer."
"Right. I didn't do it," he said. "Hand me my glasses."
They were mangled and one lens was cracked across the middle, and when he couldn't lift his left arm, I helped him put them on. Jesus Christ. Grant asked me for the remote that controlled the bed. I grabbed it, saying, "Tell me when to stop." When Grant was in a semi-sitting position, I pulled up a chair and Conklin did the same. I asked the usual first question. "Can you tell us what happened?"
"I had a hot date with a cement mixer," Grant said.
The painkiller in his IV bag was giving him quite the funny bone. I played along. I said, "Can you describe the cement mixer?" Grant cracked a giddy oxy grin.
"I think I'm starting to like you."
The feeling was not mutual. I took out my notepad and let Conklin run the interview. Even doped up, Mr. Grant was a blithe fast talker.
"Last night, I opened the back door and went for a walk. I don't know how they saw me, but a bag went over my head, made of cloth. A hood, I guess you'd call it. Then I was punched, thrown down, kicked everywhere. I screamed. Pretty sure I must have screamed very damn loud," said Grant. "I must have passed out. I woke up a couple blocks up on Hollister Avenue behind some garbage cans. I still had my phone. I called the cops. And here I am."
The jerk had slipped away from the cops assigned for his protection. I pictured Grant's neighborhood, the featureless buildings, dim lighting, the entire area on the fringe of the vibrant city of San Francisco. This was how and where the science teacher wanted to live. Isolated, so that his neighbors wouldn't object to things that went kaboom in the night. Conklin talked to Grant some more. Asked some of the questions over again, looking for discrepancies, locking his story in. He prodded and probed in his disarming way, but there was nothing to learn. The mad science teacher hadn't seen his assailants. They hadn't spoken to him, they hadn't smelled like anything, and they hadn't poked him with a gun. He said,
"For some reason, I'm still alive. I think I'm going to be released tomorrow."
Conklin said,
"Feel better."
And I added, "Please, Mr. Grant, check into a hotel." We left a pair of cops at Grant's hospital door and were heading back to the hall to brief Brady on our "no news, no leads, not much of anything to report, Lou" kind of day, when we reached the elevator bank and the doors opened. Elise Antonelli stepped out.
"Visiting my client?" she asked.
"It was a professional call," I said. Antonelli said,
I think he's going to be all right. We've been talking about you, Sergeant.
Only saying nice things, I guess.
Antonelli laughed. You'll be hearing from me soon, she said.
Then she lifted her hand in a wave and headed toward Grant's room.
What the hell was that?
Conklin asked. He jabbed the elevator button repeatedly and hard until the doors finally opened. We got inside.
Any idea?
My partner asked. I don't know what she was talking about, I said.
And I don't like the way she said it.
Chapter 64. It was after lights out time at the loony bin. Inside the ward, Nettie was in his favorite sleeping position when Mikey said from the next bed,
I can't sleep.
Nettie was so charged up with recent memories he couldn't sleep either.
Tell me the story, said Mikey.
You want me to start at the castle?
Okay, no,
Mike said.
Start at the beginning.
Scooch over, said Nettie Lambeau.
Mike shouted,
Scooch!
And pushed his bed up to Nettie's and got back under the covers. The traffic outside on Hyde Street splashed the walls with soft streaks of light. Around Mike and Nettie, the other patients in Ward 6 were in various stages of sleep.
Go on,
said Mike.
I'm ready, Nettie.
Nettie had told Mikey the story of his life maybe 100 times. His bunkie thought it was a scary fairy tale, because Nettie told it that way.
Once back in the day, I had a sister,
said Nettie. Mike said,
Victoria.
He sighed deeply and rolled onto his side facing Nettie. Nettie remembered his baby sister very well. He had been 7 and Vicky 4 when they were living with their widowed mom on a quiet block in Glen Park. Vicky was very cute and funny, with perfect features and softly dimpled hands. Their mother called Vicky her perfect little girl. And that stung Nettie bad because he knew how relieved Mommy was to have a pretty child with a normal brain, who wasn't doomed to a stunted life that was too much for any parent to bear. Nettie said to Mike,
Vicky was 20 kinds of trouble.
Tell me the kinds.
Nettie listed 3.
Noisy, nosy, bossy.
And wanting to move past this part of the story quickly, he said,
She didn't suffer. After she stopped breathing, I had to mess her up a little so that everyone could see that it was her fault for making me so mad.
Said
Mikey.
You cut off her hair and her fingers, and you stuffed her fingers into all of her bodily cavities.
Nettie's lawyer, Mr. Paul, had asked Nettie questions in such a way that Nettie knew how to tell the judge that he hadn't known what he'd done to Vicky was wrong. That meant he wasn't mentally competent to stand trial.
Your Honor, he's only 7,
the lawyer had said. Nettie hadn't gone to jail. This had been his first real-life lesson on the value of being a dummy. Mikey loved to hear about Nettie's next stop, Johnston Youth Correctional for the Criminally Insane, which, even at 7 years old, Nettie knew was completely hellish and totally wrong. Mikey said,
Now tell me about the castle, Nettie.
The prison was an old red brick building, each floor successively smaller than the lower floor.
It was big, Mikey, like a giant red chocolate cake with candles and flags and a dungeon, of course. Mwah!
Mikey said,
Mwah!
Then begged for more. Nettie described the rambling facility in morbidly fleshed out detail, returning repeatedly to the dark, tiny cells just big enough for a collie. The inmates received random and often experimental medical care, and every once in a while they were hosed down with a power washer. The food was blended mush baked into a nutrition loaf. The windows were small, high up, and barred. The toilets were execrable. The all-day, all-night screaming was intolerable. And when the 200 prisoners weren't caged, chained, or isolated in the dungeon, there were bloody fights and suicides.
For Nettie, Johnston Correctional was a crash course in survival. That didn't mean he had to be passive. Nettie told Mikey, again, that after someone had broken a nurse's neck because she refused to give him a glass of milk, Johnston Youth Correctional for the Criminally Insane had been shut down. He had no regrets. Nursey had reminded him of his mother, who had been both afraid of and revolted by her son, and as soon as he had been locked up at Johnston, she had moved far away, leaving no forwarding address. Nettie had never heard from her again. When Johnston was closed, the youthful offenders were parceled out to other facilities around the state, and Nettie was bused to Hyde Street Psychiatric. He was 12 by then, and the hide-and-seek loony bin seemed like some kind of heaven in comparison to Johnston. The food groups were identifiable and often tasty. There were real shrinks and doctors, and they were interested in him, even though they never agreed on what exactly was wrong with Nettie. Nettie knew. He was a genius, a rare type of genius. And 30 years ago, when he'd turned 18, he'd gotten privileges. Nettie told Mikey,
"Whoever killed Nursey was an unsung hero."
You know what that means, Mike?
He never got credit. No one ever knew who killed that horrible old woman.
Silence from the next bed. Nettie tucked sleeping Mikey's blankets around him and settled himself down. Old show tunes came from the computer in the nurse's station just outside the door. Within this cocoon of safety and comfort, Nettie thought fondly about his life at the bin. He was loved and trusted here. Maybe someday Nettie Lambeau would get the respect he deserved. Not maybe. He was certain of it. Because he had definitely earned it. Chapter 65. My phone alarm buzzed, and for a long moment I didn't have the will to get out of bed. But the choice was taken out of my hands. Martha gave me a sloppy facial. Julie cranked up the first notes of her full-throated cry, and if I didn't move fast, I was going to be late for work. I sprang from my cocoon and went straight for Julie's room. Once I had her in my arms, Mrs. Rose arrived, and together we launched the morning routine of food for little girl, dog walk, and caffeine with plenty of sugar for me. As Mrs. Rose ran the dishwasher, I checked the TV news. Elise Antonelli, Connor Grant's attorney, was giving a press conference outside San Francisco General, and her client, who was bruised, bandaged, and deadpan, was standing beside her. Antonelli was saying, "On behalf of my client, we are filing a complaint against Sergeant Lindsay Boxer with the Internal Affairs Bureau of the San Francisco Police Department. IAB is charged with investigating crimes against citizens or other police officers. In the case of Sergeant Boxer, we are claiming unlawful violation of personal liberty, which means false imprisonment. We are further claiming that she lied about my client, resulting in his criminal prosecution for 25 murders. My client was tried and found not guilty on all counts by his jury, but the publicity generated by this trial resulted in several near-fatal attacks on Mr. Grant's life." Elise Antonelli put up a hand to block reporters' questions. "In a conversation with the mayor this morning, we have been assured that Sergeant Boxer will be thoroughly investigated, and if found in the wrong, she will be separated from, that is, fired by, the SFPD. The press could no longer be constrained. Questions were fired from all sides, but I'd stopped listening. Antonelli's public statement that I was being investigated was too damned real and sent me into some kind of shock. I stared at the tube, open-mouthed, fingers tingling, specks floating in front of my eyes. Mrs. Rose called in from the kitchen.
What did she say?
I shut off the TV and brought Mrs. Rose into the loop on the beating of Connor Grant and how I wasn't surprised that he wanted to hurt somebody. He's an opportunist, and that's the very kindest thing I can say about him, I told her. I'll be okay. I'll be fine. She gave me a look that was both hard and questioning. She knew me well. She knew that I was worried sick. A half hour later, wearing my imaginary cloak of invisibility, I entered the hall through the back door and ran up the stairs. Brenda, our squad assistant, snagged me the moment I stepped into the bullpen.
You're very popular, she said,
handing me a list of one-on-one meetings she'd scheduled for me with Brady, Jacoby, Nash, who is our new head of PR, and Len Parisi. There was also a note from Parisi reading, "Don't speak with anyone but your union rep and the people on the list." My rep? I was scared. I had done nothing wrong. But what if I was somehow found responsible for violating Grant's rights? What then? My resources were finite. Joe wasn't working, and after a dismissal for cause, I might never be able to work as a cop again. I dropped into my desk chair, and I didn't care that he wasn't on Parisi's approved list. I told Conklin all about it. After that, I went to my meetings with the brass, and I called Joe. We talked for over an hour from my seat in the fire stairs. By the time Claire called to ask if I was free for dinner with Cindy and Yuki, I was ripping mad. I said to Claire, "God, yes to dinner. Connor Grant killed 25 people and he's going after me? I want to see all of you. Really bad." Chapter 66. After work, I drove to Susie's Cafe, our longtime Women's Murder Club HQ. I arrived first, commandeered our booth in the back room, and ordered a pitcher of brew. Yuki and Cindy arrived next, slid into the seat across from me. Cindy said, "Oh my God, Lindsay, what is the story with Grant filing a complaint against you?" Yuki poured Cindy a beer, saying, "You're a touch wired, Sin. Not another word until you drink this down."
"Oh no, you're going to torture me with beer?"
Yuki laughed, which lifted my mood and had a similar effect on the 6 or 7 people within range of her melodious chortle. Cindy looked pleased to get such a big laugh on her small joke, and I refilled my glass. I wasn't yet laughing. I wasn't sure beer could help me. About then, Claire arrived like a stiff breeze, knocking silverware to the floor as she edged between other tables and ours. She apologized, bent to retrieve a spoon, and knocked into another table, scattering more silverware. Our waitress skidded to a halt, balancing full dishes of pulled pork, as Yuki scrambled to help Claire in that narrow aisle. Oh man, everyone was laughing at our clumsy gang. "We're going to make it easy on you," Claire said to Lorraine. She ordered the Tuesday night special, $7 a plate spicy shrimp dinner all around. And then Claire asked me to tell what I knew about the complaint. But I wasn't supposed to talk to anyone, right? "No, I'm under orders from Parisi to keep quiet, so you go ahead," I told Claire.
"You sure?"
"Start talking, Claire, or someone's going to beat you to it."
"Okay, then,"
she said. "Get this. One of the EMTs who picked up Sarah Nugent outside the Admiral Dewey Hotel remembered something that didn't register at the time." Claire had our full attention. Forks paused in midair. "What did he remember?" I asked. Claire said, "He saw a medical vial in the gutter. So now he and his partner drive over to the hotel and find this empty vial. It's labeled succinylcholine." Cindy asked,
"What's that?"
"Sux is a colorless, odorless muscle relaxant, a short-term paralytic used primarily for intubation," said Claire. "It can be administered intravenously. It can also be injected intramuscularly." I said, "I see where you're going. You think the victims were injected with that?"
"It makes sense," said Claire. "If used intravenously, Sux works within a minute or two. If you're not on a respirator, you will stop breathing and you will die. Intramuscularly, it takes longer for the paralysis to hit, so you buy another minute or so, but it's the same issue. Without going on a respirator PDQ, you will die."
Yuki asked her,
"But why didn't the tox screens pick it up?"
Claire said,
"Because Sux metabolizes into succinate. That's a naturally occurring substance we all have in our blood, so very quickly it's undetectable."
"I think we've got our smoking gun, Linz."
"I'm sure of it. The bottle is on the way to the lab. Let's pray that CSI finds prints on it, okay?"
I said, "Sure." Claire said,
"You all think I'm kidding."
She folded her hands and closed her eyes. Right there in Susie's raucous, curry-perfumed Caribbean eatery, with the sounds of steel drums and laughter in our ears, we followed Claire's lead. We prayed for CSI to find fingerprints on a small bottle that might lead to a serial killer. We really prayed. Chapter 67. Cindy came back to the table from the washroom.